last two Sundays. And I just want to say I really appreciate your prayers on our behalf as we were in Idaho. I preached 8 times in about 4 days, and that's a stretch for me. And I felt the Lord's presence, and I felt your prayers. And we had a good time with the church there, and also with our two sons and their families. And got to hold my grandson Fletcher for the first time, which was a blessing. This past Sunday, we were at Elkhart and preached up there. Collier was going as well, so we calculated last Sunday that 5 of us preachers from Sandy Ridge were preaching. And poor Kendall, I think, was stuck here by himself, but I think it was probably good. So we're grateful to be here tonight. And the services that we're having this weekend are different, somewhat different than what we normally have. And we're grateful to have Leroy Hirschberger with us, storyteller Leroy with us. And by way of introduction, I could probably just say that he's Mark Nisley Rose's brother, or it'd be Ira's daughter-in-law's brother. And Leroy, the oldest of 9 siblings, got his start in storytelling by entertaining his nieces and nephews. He tells stories of Amish family life, of nature, folklore, and sacred wisdom. Leroy grew up in Wisconsin and has lived in Reno County, Kansas since 1984, and that's where my wife is from as well, so we have some connection there. He has a degree in English from Yale University, repairs farm machinery, teaches Sunday school and high school shop classes. And he likes to travel, bicycling, and mountaineering. His most formative adult adventure was a year spent with the MCC trainee program working on small dairy farms in Switzerland and southern Germany. Leroy believes that storytelling not only delights, but also enlightens and heals. Storytelling is a distinctly human characteristic, and everyone should do it. Leroy just returned from being in Ireland for 10 days, I think he said. And he's still suffering somewhat, I think, from jet lag, although I didn't notice a whole too big of an issue here, because he is full of interesting things. So there's never a dull moment. I've experienced that in the last day. I haven't known him well, but I have known him for quite a few years. So we're grateful to have him here this evening and the next evenings. And we're going to provide and he'll probably take care of this, a question time. If you have questions after he's finished talking, he's going to give you that opportunity. You're welcome to ask questions. And we didn't talk about this, but we'll probably take an offering for Leroy. His time here, we usually do that, Friday nights, or should we do that Sunday evening? One of those evenings. We'll try to let you know on our group me when we do that for sure. I'll talk it over with the other minister that's here. Vansons are coming home late tonight. They're not home yet. They're coming home from Belize. So we look forward to seeing them again. We've had 3 of their children at our house for the past week. And so Grandma and myself were reminded of what it is to take care of children. And that was a blessing to have them there, for the most part. No, it was a blessing to have them there. We're planning on a fellowship dinner, I think, on Sunday. So keep that in mind. Any announcements that need to be made that I'm missing right now? David?
This is an announcement concerning Daryl. Maybe some of you guys know, but he had a tick bite. A couple weeks ago, and he has Lyme's disease. And so I guess this morning or last night, he was had a splitting headache, and he was really fatigued this morning. So I guess I'm just, if the church could pray for him, and as he, he's on some really strong antibiotic, and I guess if they don't get it right away, it can, I think it can be, it's not really good. And so I just pray that God would work in his body and that he could find some healing.
Thank you, David. Anyone else? Let's bow our heads for prayer. Lord, just now we think of Daryl and this Lyme disease, and we pray that the medicine, the medication, the antibiotic, the strong antibiotic that he's taking now, and other medications that would help to alleviate any further issues would be available for him and he could recover. We're grateful for the opportunity of being together this evening. Thank you for bringing our brother Leroy. We ask that you would bless him as he shares with us tonight, and ask that our time together would honor you and glorify your name. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. We'll turn the time over to you now, Leroy. May the Lord bless you.
Well, greetings to all of you from Reno County, Kansas. It is a pleasure to be here. I arrived yesterday at 4 p.m. John picked me up, and he and Esther have been wonderful hosts to me already. Today, I had lunch with Norman and Allison, and they both, their favorite thing was the butter bread with strawberry jam on it. So it's kind of like, you know, from old age to youth, they both had that in common. It was great fun. And I looked at Galen's shop and every wonderful little piece of equipment in there. And I know a lot more about Lazy Susans now than I did even this morning. So it was wonderful. And I see Collier here. Thank you for getting me here. It is always It's an honor and a privilege to speak to anyone, especially to young people, and I'm pleased to see that there are a bunch of you here. Back in Reno County, Kansas, I run a repair shop. I work on farm equipment, and young people are my key to keeping the work going because they try out the tractors and break the clutches and, you know, pop wheelies and stuff, and then the dads bring them over to me, and I put them together again, and then we take them out again. Some of them I call my test pilots. I also teach high school shop class, so welding, small engine repair, and intro to automotive mechanics. And I want to just say one thing about that. All of my students have to learn how to juggle. That's one of the rules. And if you're the teacher, you can make rules like that. And they just kind of look at me like, well, I guess we have to. And so far, that they have to do that if they want to pass the class. And so far, everyone has passed. And my point here is it's not good enough just to know stuff in your head. If you're going to work in my shop or in anybody's shop and do a good job, you're going to have hand-eye coordination. And juggling's a wonderful way to get that going. And then if you need extra credit, I have a couple of unicycles, and you can learn to ride those too. So I teach that, and some of my guys are so good, they can ride a unicycle and juggle at the same time. I'm ready to hire those guys right now. Yeah. So I'm fortunate because I do things that I like almost every day, and it doesn't feel like work to me, and I would wish that on everyone. My mom used to say, when it was my turn or whoever's turn of my siblings to wash dishes, we would say, oh, do we have to? And she'd say, well, if you want to, you don't have to. And we used to fight with that. We'd say, well, I want to, so now I don't have to, right? She'd say, yeah, good. Go ahead and enjoy it. But that's really a fine thing. And what I've learned in going through my life is that you can't argue with taste. in work, in play, in food, for sure. But everyone can develop taste. And that's what we're called to do. We're called to develop tastes that are conducive to community, that build the Church of Jesus Christ. And we even if we think, oh, well, that's not my thing, I don't like it, we can change that. We really can. So that's the wonderful thing about storytelling, is it gives a little bit of a chance to change, and it's sometimes even pleasurable. So in 1992, I came home from university, and I kind of looked for a job teaching, just half-heartedly. You know, I was going to teach English. That was my degree. And you know, what I found out is Americans don't value English very much at all. And I could have started out at, I think it was $16,000 a year, something like that. And I sort of looked around, and I had a whole bunch of Amish farmers, and they had broken tractors. And they were like, Leroy, please fix my tractor. And they had their checkbooks open, ready to like write out checks. And I had accumulated a little bit of debt going to school. And so it was pretty easy for me to just switch on, you know, my work clothes and just start repairing tractors again. And I got people who would say things like, you know, you're the best educated mechanic who's ever worked on this tractor. They would rip me like that. And there were other people who were like, so why were you going to school? Were you going to learn how to be a mechanic? And I had to say no. And then and people would ask, well, when did you start doing mechanics? And I thought about it, and I couldn't remember. Ever since my earliest memories, that's what I did. I helped my dad. So I asked my mom one day, and she said, she thought a little bit, and she said, oh, I remember the first time you were in the shop helping dad with mechanics. And she told me this story, and I don't remember it. It was too far back. But it, you know, I got some independent verification, and I know it's true. And it goes like this. I was 8 months old. I'm the oldest child, so my mom didn't have any helpers. It was August. She was at the wood-fired cook stove, and she was trying to can tomato juice. And I was on the floor, and it was hot. And I was grumpy, and I was pulling on her dress and crying and carrying on, only like an eight-month-old could, you know, couldn't walk yet. And it was dangerous. You know, I could have been doused with hot tomato juice, and so my mom decided all on a whim, she just filled a tub with water, big, put it on the front porch, took all my clothes off and plunked me in there, and I thought it was a great idea. I was splashing around having a good time. She went back into the kitchen to do her work, and later came back to check on me, and I was gone. I had escaped. Apparently, I'd gotten out, I crawled out of that tub of water and across the front porch, and I worked my way backwards down the front porch steps, crawled out across the yard, worked on the yard gate and got it open, crawled out the little lane, down the road in front of the house, and she found me on the other side of the road near the barn in the little workshop where my dad was repairing Maytag washing machine engines. And I was sitting with the greasy parts, and I was playing with them, and I had grease all over me, and I was buck naked. And she was, you know, good. You know, she found me, and, you know, I cleaned up okay, everybody would have forgotten about that, except apparently while I was working my way on my hands and knees across the gravel road, a buggy came by, clop, 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 clop. This was in Buchanan County in Iowa. Big Amish community there. And we still don't know who was in that buggy. But the conversation must have gone something like this. Hey, to, you know, the wife, that looks like William and Elizabeth Leroy out there on the road naked. And, you know, the husband's like, well, yeah, sure enough, it does. And they did not stop to help me. They just clopped right on by, and the best I know is there were lots and lots of little children back in that time and in that place, and, you know, if you lost one down the road, there were more, I guess. But these people, they were concerned about propriety, And later that week, they saw Deacon Ed Gingrich. And they remembered to tell him that they saw me out naked where the English neighbors could see me. And you know, Elizabeth just doesn't quite have sense in her head, and maybe you should go talk to her about that. Yeah. That's how it happened that my mom looked out the window and saw Deacon Ed Gingrich's rig pull up and tie at the hitching rack. And when he got out and he had on his good Sunday clothes on, and it was Thursday, she was like, uh-oh. Something is wrong here. And she was, going through her mind, the possibilities, and she was nervous. And for some of you, you might not understand how it works in an Amish community, so I'll just explain the role of the deacon a little bit. There are three big things that a deacon has to do, and deacons don't choose to be deacons. They are ordained by lot. And so you can't argue with God. You just have to step up and do your job. And the first thing is you have to develop a clear reading voice because it's your job to read the scripture on Sunday. And the next thing that you have to do is you've got to look out for the alms fund. Anybody who needs help, you figure out how to help them discreetly with some money without embarrassing them. And you've got to make sure that you use the money wisely because, people are expecting you to do that. And then the third thing is by far the hardest thing for an Amish deacon. Whenever there's a problem in the church, and it usually involves a person, that's usually where the problems are, is with people. Well, the ministers have to discuss this, and they have to figure out what's a discreet and a sensible way to address the problem. And they work that out, and when they finally decide what to do, the deacon is the messenger boy. And he's got to go tell the people, the person or the people who had the problem, how to solve it. And so people associate rebuke and correction with the deacon, and it's not quite fair, but that's the way it is. And I'll give you some examples of problems that would have happened in the community where I was born, in Buchanan County. They had rules that were a little different from the rules in the Amish churches around here, I think. One of them was no middle names. That was that was what people did who were arrogant and you wanted a big, fat, long name. Well, not us. We are simple people and we have one name, a given name, and then our family name. Well, my mom really she wanted to name me after my Uncle Roy. And she also wanted to name me after my grandfather, Levi. And so she put Lee Roy together, and she knew she couldn't do the two names, so she put them together, but she made the Roy with a capital R there. Just, to kind of push it a little bit. That was kind of, she was young. You know how young women and men are sometimes. And then Rose Anna, whom you know, her name's spelled with a capital A in there, too. Kind of two words. And then we moved. We moved to New Glarus, and the restrictions were diminished. And so it was Miriam Joy with a space between it next, and David Allen. And we made sure we got two big, solid names in there, right? Because we could. Another rule where I was born was houses had to be painted white, and barns were red. And so let's just say an Amishman, bought the neighbor's farm, and he was not Amish, and so he'd have painted his house white because he just liked it. Well, you would have had until the next communion to get that thing painted red. And if you didn't, the deacon would have to come explain to you about the slippery slope and all that stuff. And you'd say, well, why does it really matter? White, red, whatever, and he'd have to say something like, we've always done it this way, and it's a tradition that hasn't killed us. And that way you know not to act like an animal when you're in the house. It's the different colors. It helps, color coordinate. Or something like that. I don't know. But that was the deacon's job. You had to be tactful and say hard things. And one more example of this. I remember once coming to visit my grandparents in Buchanan after we were gone. And my grandfather, Levi, he was upset. And he was just kind of walking like an upset guy, you know, and he was kind of grumpy, you know, how people are. And I was trying to figure out what was wrong. I was just a little boy. And I saw he had his buggy in his workshop, and he'd just gotten done reupholstering the front seat. And it looked beautiful to me. Brass tacks all around the edge, nice black Naugahyde, and, you know, filled up with stuffing and nice, not very lumpy and anything. And I was looking out, and then I found out, well, it was the second time he had reupholstered it in 2 weeks. So we had to hear the story, and it went like this. Grandma was like, we have big rips in the Naugahyde. This buggy is not fit to be seen when we go to church. And so, you know, Grandpa, go fix it. And he's, oh, all right, yeah, okay. And he went out in his little workshop, and he remembered that up in the loft he had part of a roll of Naugahyde. He might not even have to go to town or spend any money. So he climbed up there, and he found this nice roll, and it was just long enough to do the seat. And it was dark navy blue. But he thought, you know, it's so close to black, it ought to work. And, you know, they'd moved from over here by Middlebury, and back in Middlebury, dark blue worked okay. So he just went ahead and did it because it was cheaper, and, you know, that trumps sometimes getting it just right. And it was all good, and Grandma was happy, and they drove to church with it. But wouldn't you know, Deacon Ed saw that, and he noticed that it wasn't black. And he had to come see my grandfather, a man, you know, 15 years older than he was, and explain to him that we've got to be good examples to the young people. And he was not happy, but he knew deep in his guts that you've got to do what's asked of you if you're going to live in community. And so even though he didn't like it, he did it. Took that Naugahyde all off, went into town, bought a piece, and tacked it all back on there, and it was done, and it was good, but he was still a little stiff about it. Anyway, that's the Amish deacon, and he was there to see my mom, and she was nervous. And so he came in, and the way he usually did it is you don't just launch right into the hard conversation. You talk about the weather, and about how the cows are milking and what the price of pigs are down at the sale barn and anything else you can think of. And finally, it's come to my attention that you let Leroy play naked outside where the neighbors could see him, the English neighbors. Oh, my mom breathed a sigh of relief. She had a whole list of options, and this was one that she hadn't even thought of. And she threw me under the bus. She said it was my fault. She did not plan to have me out naked. I escaped and climbed out, and she talked fast and convincingly enough that she did not have to make a confession in church. She said it was the only time that ever worked. She got out of that. And that was the most embarrassing thing you could imagine. Stand up with everyone and say, look, I've made a mistake, and I'm sorry, and I will do better later. Shame was a big deal back then. So she worked her way out of that, and this little story is simply here to illustrate, one, how I got my start in mechanics, and it was also the very first time that I got in trouble with the church. And I couldn't even walk yet. So now you know a little bit more about me. I'm going to do little bits of storytelling tips because I think everybody's a storyteller. And I'll just do them here and there between stories. So I want to tell you this is something I believe. I believe that stories impose order and meaning on the stream of events that make up our lives. You know, all this stuff is happening to us constantly, and we can't remember all of it. And if we don't organize it in some way, our lives just kind of flow by, and we're not sure, and our memory fails. And so stories is what we do to organize stuff that happens and give it meaning. And meaning is one of the keys to memory. If something means something to us, we can then remember it. And our memory is who we are. And you don't think about that until you have a friend who gets old, or maybe not so old, and they start suffering from dementia. And at first it's just like, well, personality's changing, and then finally it's like, the person I have known and loved is no longer here because their memories are gone. And it's the most haunting and terrifying thing, really, to think of that. It's one of the things we can look forward to at the resurrection is that we'll have our memories back again, and they will be good, and we will be recognized for who we are and who we were. Paul Wengert lives in Thomas, Oklahoma, and you might have heard of him. He was trying to save a little money, and he tried to put argon gas into an LP gas tank, and it exploded. And he lost both of his legs and one of his arms. And he did a little safety routine. He'd come around and talk to businesses about safety, and everybody sat up and listened because he had cred. He said, you know, don't do what I did. I was trying to save $55. And so he goes around and he says, so would you let me saw off your leg if I gave you $55? And of course, no. Well, what about $550? He bids you up. How about 5,500? Come on, you know. Well, what about 55,000? Makes a really good point about thinking twice and turning the valves open only once. He found out I'd gone to school. He was trying to figure out what to do with his life. He couldn't farm anymore, so he was going to school. And he looked at me and he said, when he heard this, he said, what are you doing with your education? He just said it like that because he thought I should be doing, I don't know. He just wanted to know. And so I've thought about that. I thought about it before he asked me, but I thought a little more. And these are some of the responses I give. One is I quote Aristotle because he's an old man who's, you know, somewhat wise, we think. He said education is the preparation for old age. So I was thinking, you know, when I can't climb mountains and I can't repair equipment, maybe I can still read and think and maybe write. So that was one thing. Maybe tell a story or two. Teaching skills. When you study, you learn how to learn. And that's something that every person's interested in. We're trying to get skills as we grow from being a child. And so I talked a little about auto mechanics, welding, and juggling, and speaking. Many of you, older ones at least, remember my sister Rose. Rose can speak really well. She's a teacher. She's done that a lot. My sisters, for some reason, they just, you know, they can do it without really trying. They read, they write, they play Scrabble like pros. And it wasn't as easy for me. And so one of the great gifts I got from devoting myself to studying for about 5 years in higher education is I got a voice. I'm able to speak. I'm able to write in ways that I did not know how to do before that. So I'm very grateful for that. Being human means we kind of emphasize things that maybe other animals can't do so well. So language is one of those things. And so language is very important. What else? One more thing on storytelling. Storytelling is first about noticing stuff. I like drawing and sketching, so I took classes doing that. Well, part of it is learning about motor control, getting to do things. But more important than that, if you want to draw something, is learning to look very carefully and observe and see exactly what's there in the first place. It made me focus. And when I tell stories, to get there, I really have to focus on what it is that I want to speak about. What's the story about? I zero in on it. Fred Rogers said this. He said, appreciation, and this is about focus usually, is a holy thing. When we look for what's best in the person we happen to be with at the moment, we're doing what God does. So in appreciating our neighbor, we're participating in something truly sacred. And I think he's right on that. And sometimes we forget, we're in a world where speaking the truth and pointing out people's errors is really popular, and we feel kind of prophetic about this and everything. Well, it turns out that's pretty easy to do. What's harder to do is building community. And we do that by cultivating knowledge about each other and by appreciating and accentuating the good things that people do. Changes our whole life when we zero in on those things. That's enough lecturing. Let's go to another story. Ah, water. I liked school. I started out in kindergarten at the New Glarus Grade School in southwestern Wisconsin. And one of my favorite things was lunch, because we had hot lunch there. You could bring 15 cents, and then you'd get your tray, and you'd go by, and there were lunch ladies, and they had little rubber thingies on their hair, and they would clump out spoonfuls of stuff on your tray as you went by there, and then you'd take that over, and you'd sit with your friends, and you'd eat it, and it was so much fun. And if you brought 20 cents, you could get a milk, either a white milk or a chocolate milk. And they were in those little cardboard things that you had to sort of spread open, and then you pulled them just right, and it would open, and then you could slurp your milk out of there. Or if you didn't get it right, you'd have to, like, dig with your fork and get it out. It was hard. But, you know, it was one of those things you had to learn if you were going to get through first grade. Well, my favorite thing of all and the hot lunch was shoestring potatoes. I loved shoestring potatoes. And you know how it is, you get this in your head, and then you go away, and then about 30 years later, you think, wow, shoestring potatoes, I haven't had those since first grade. And so I got some not too long ago somewhere, and I was all prepared to really have a nice deja vu thingy going on. They're like eating matchsticks. They're basically just reasons to, like, get a lot of ketchup and eat it. That's really what they're good for. So it's kind of disappointing, but, you know, you got to get in touch with the reality there. So in the middle of second grade, my mom and dad moved. What happened is the Mennonites found us. And just to sort of explain how all went about, my parents moved from Buchanan County to Greene County, which was in Wisconsin, because land was cheap and because some of their friends were looking for farms, and so we all moved out there, and there we were. And we brought our plows, we brought our horses, we brought our buggies, all the stuff we thought we needed to make a community. But the one thing that nobody thought about was problem-solving skills. And wouldn't you know, we thought, you know, a new community wouldn't have any problems because we were making the rules, tweaking them a little bit. We could have chainsaws here. We wouldn't have to use a crosscut saw. I mean, how could anybody be grumpy with that change? But there were problems, and it turned out that every community has problems. And we had a hard one right off, and we couldn't solve it. I mean, I was too little to be a part of the problem even there. But it ended up ruining the church. People moved away over that. And so in that process, the Mennonites found us. And so we ended up going to a Mennonite church in Muscadet. And I'll talk a little more about that another evening. But the thing was, we showed up after we moved, and no more public school, because the Mennonites had a parochial school. It was Muscadet Christian Day School. And I remember the first day going to that school. I was in the middle of second grade. Rose was in kindergarten, but they didn't have kindergarten, so she had to go right off into first grade. Dad dropped us off at the front door, and he went off to work at Easy Trail. And I remember, you know, it was just right at 9 o'clock, and so everybody was already going inside, and we were walking up and looking around, and here to the site in front of the schoolhouse was a pump, just a big old pump. And there was a tin drinking cup there, and if you were thirsty, you raised your hand, and the teacher would let you come out, and you'd pump and get some water and drink it. And at later that winter, one of the eighth graders told me to lick the pump handle because it was all white and frosty. And I still remember thinking, it must taste good, and I licked it. And I still remember that feeling of like your tongue is stuck to the cast iron. And I wasn't, you know, and it didn't warm up. It just stayed frozen there. And I finally just pulled away, and it hurt like fire. And I remember the shape of the skin from my tongue still on there. I learned. I never did that again. We came on in there, and we opened the door, and we're looking around, you know, just little children, you know, and we didn't have helicopter moms or lawnmower mom at that time. They just dropped us off, and we're going to have to either, you know, make it or not on our own. There were hooks, a whole row of hooks with coats and boots underneath, a little name on top of each hook, and we got our hook and our name later on. And then over here to the side in the ante room was an old, rusty electric stove. And beside it here was an old, rusty electric refrigerator. And beside the refrigerator was a wooden table. And on the table were lunch pails. And they were amazing lunch pails. There was one that had Huey, Dewey, and Louie on it. And there was a Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs one, too. I remember this. It was just wow. And we were so interested in the lunch pails and what would be in them. And at lunchtime, we were watching everybody. And you know what they ate, those children? They got out. They had Wonder Bread sandwiches with Boughten grape jelly and Boughten peanut butter in them, and they were cut on the diagonal. And they had Snickers bars and Butterfinger candy bars, the little ones. Some of them had two. And then the other thing they had was chips. And they weren't chips, you know, out of a big bag put in baggies. They were chips in those little real chip bags that fit right in your lunch pail. And when you open them, they would go poof. And they had soda pop that they put in the refrigerator, that rusty refrigerator, and they would go and open it and swig that down, and the little ones would burp. Bleh. We were really impressed. And when we got home that evening, we said, "Mom," and we proceeded to do our best at convincing Mom that we needed sandwiches cut on the diagonal, and soda pop, and you know, white wonder, all that stuff, and poof, you know, we've got to have those, because everybody in school is doing this. And Mom listened to us. She didn't say anything until we were all kind of winded. And you know what she said then? She said, "The whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead." We were not reaching the woman. And we tried again. And I tell you, it was life or death for us, right? Because you got to fit in or something horrible is going to happen to you. You just know that, right? So we went on some more. But you have to understand about Mom and Dad. When they moved from Buchanan County to New Glarus, what was happening was old farmers were wanting to retire, but their children had gone off to Madison, to the University of Wisconsin, and they weren't coming back because they liked 8 to 5. And they liked the steady income, and they liked to be warm in the wintertime. And so these people were selling out to Amish farmers, and the other thing was hippies, people we called hippies. They came out from Madison. They were dropping out of the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and they came out to buy little farms for cheap, and they were trying to get relevant, which meant you bought some goats, and you tried to milk them, and you tried to plant, you know, and they did the best they could, of course. And it was kind of comical. I remember we in our buggy clopping along, and we'd be staring. We'd be rubbernecking the hippie neighbors, because it was like Amish farm, hippie farm, Amish, hippie, you know. It was just kind of mixed in together there. we would stare at them, you know, and it's like, oh my goodness, look at those rows and what weeds we have there. And they would be driving their VW minibuses things, and they would be staring at us. It was like going to the zoo both ways. And finally, one of the neighbors, they were brave enough, they stopped in with their VW minibus, microbus, whatever it was, you know, those little funny buses. And they were admiring our tomatoes out in the garden. I was out with my mom, and we were doing stuff, and we had nice tomatoes, and my mom said, well, have one. And this hippie guy, he just plucked this nice tomato size of an apple, and he just bit a big bite out of it and ate it right there without butter and salt and putting it on a bread or anything. I was kind of surprised at that. And he was going on about how wonderful it was, and oh, my goodness. And my mom was like, well, you know, this is how you do it, and you hoe and get things ready, and you keep the weeds out. And in the process, she got to feeling that she was kind of an expert at gardening. Because these people were, ooh, wow, ah, and we're going to go home and try that. And then they wanted to talk with my dad because the goats just weren't performing. And he didn't know that much about goats, but he knew which end of the horse you put the oats in. And he knew how to get milk out of a cow. So he told them everything he knew, and he started feeling like he knew important things too. And it ended up that the hippies, my mom got her first granola recipe from those hippies, and she still makes that granola, we still eat it. And we became friends, and we go back and forth, and they had kickwheel pottery. It was amazing. And they did other fun stuff that they did really well that we had no idea about. So we ended up learning a lot from each other. And in the process, my parents got to believe that raising your own food and knowing where it came from and being self-sufficient was a really important thing. And so when we came home from that unenlightened little Christian day school and requested all that bought and stuff, my mom was not about to cave on that one. So we just had to deal with it. So my mom was thinking, oh, well, the poor little dears, I'm going to fix them a nice lunch tomorrow. And what she did is she found this wicker basket. It had two handles. And she fixed us. Uh-oh. Are we okay? Was it something I said? No. It's just a long time, isn't it? She fixed us. She put a kettle in there, a stainless steel kettle, a quart of homemade chili, a pint of dill pickles that she'd made, and half a loaf of whole wheat bread and a big slab of butter. Yeah. We thought it was awful, too. She put this checkered tablecloth, you know, red and white checker, and we had to lug that thing up and put it next to those Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and that stuff. And Rose had to get up out of her desk 10 minutes to 12 and go put the kettle on the stove and put the chili in there, glug, glug, glug. And then we had to sit at the class table up on the little stage because our desks were angly and, you know, the stuff would roll off. And we had to eat that homemade chili out of those yellow Tupperware bowls, the ones that scritch loudly when you move your spoon around there. We were up there, scritch, scritch, eating, and everybody was looking at us, you know, and we had weird stuff. And I remember Donald, he was in my grade, came up to have a closer look, and he was like, what is that stuff you're eating? And I'm like, it's chili, it's homemade, it's good. And he was kind of like, ew, and he went back to his Snickers bar. And Roxanne was interested in the bread, and she came and had a look at that. Never seen brown bread like that before. And she decided she'd rather have Wonder Bread. Went back to her desk. That was our life. I don't know how we made it through that school. If it wasn't that, it was my mom would go down to the spring, and she would cut off watercress. And my dad was into making artisan cheese, although it wasn't called that. It was just called experimentation back then. You had never had the same batch taste the same. Some of it tasted like something other than cheese, but you know, it was uneven, but you know, interesting. Let's say so. My mom would make these little whole wheat buns, slice them in half, and put a pawful of of watercress in there and a slab of homemade cheese and a little mayo, and that was our lunch, you know, and we had to eat those. And she was quick, and she was in a hurry. She was kind of like Heather, actually. And there were snails in there sometimes, and you'd just be biting along, and I kind of like watercress, but the snails just, they interrupted the flow. They really did. And we complained about that, and she just said, oh, that's just your protein. Don't worry about it. I don't know how we made it through that school, but somehow we did. We graduated, we learned to read and write and do a little arithmetic, and we got through that. And the weird thing now is, all these years later, I pay good money for artisan cheese, and I love watercress. Whenever I find it, you know, I get it. And whole wheat bread is, that's a delicate, that's what I want. And it's somehow, in the process of all that, you know, Mom kind of knew what she was doing. She developed tastes that have stood with us all these years. And the other thing that I've been thinking about that she taught us is sometimes doing what everybody else is doing isn't a good idea, and you've got to be able to think for yourself. And of course, you can take that too far, but part of what we want to teach our children, and my mom did, is be wise. Don't simply go with the herd every time. Think about what you do. And so even, I'm just telling you, some of you little children here, even if you think your parents are weird, don't let it get you down. You'll probably survive. My sister Rose and I did. So that's school lunches for you. Someone once said that education should equip you to entertain three things: an idea, a friend, and yourself. And storytelling can be part of that education. We have a lot of ideas, and sometimes we lecture, and we shake our finger. You know, that's what you do when you lecture. You should do this, and no, you should not do that. And you do have lists, and you have PowerPoint lists, and all that stuff. And if you ever notice, this is one of your homework assignments, you know, it's important to have lectures, and it's important to have lists and you know, explain things, but you will notice sometimes if the sermon's getting a little long and there's a lot of lecturing going on, that some of the dairy farmer people, their heads will start going down like this. And if you notice very carefully, you'll see a little drool sort of coming out of the edge of the, into their shirt pocket right here. And then, just by some miracle, the sermon turns into a narrative, and it's an illustrative story that explains how it works. And and you'll notice those tired little heads, they will just kind of like come up like this, and the eyes open up, and they start listening. And it's just that magic that storytelling will do. People just can't help it. They're wired to hear a story. It just feeds in, and it works really well. So there's a reason that if you have really important things to say, that you'll do it in story form. And of course, we have the wonderful example in the Gospels of Jesus teaching. A lot of what he did was tell stories, parables. And he wouldn't explain them always to everybody. He'd just tell the story, and then you had to figure it out. That was part of the homework, I guess. And the disciples would afterwards say, hey, what in the world was that all about? And then he would proceed to explain it a little bit more, and so we get kind of insights on that. But that's kind of the way, I mean, it's illustrating the value of storytelling. I think we have time for another one. I tell people sometimes that I learned part of my storytelling stuff from Amish power visiting. And then people say, well, what's Amish power visiting? And this is the way it works. You show up, and this is not so much anymore because people have phones, but it used to be you didn't have phones. And you couldn't let people know, and you had a chance maybe to hop on a van and go see to another community and visit your relatives. And you just showed up quick, and there's no way to let them know. They look out, there's a van, and a bunch of people boil out of it, and they're there for the day. And you were busy, you know, you had planned to do this, that, and the other thing,
but visitors are a great honor. So you just unhitch the horses and, you know, and you everybody goes into the house and they sit down in the living room and you start talking. And you tell stories. And you tell whatever was embarrassing or practical jokes were a great story. And what practical means in jokes is that somebody got hurt, like it hurt as part of the joke, just so you know. If you ever hear that you heard it from me, that's how it works. So you sit there and you spend a couple of hours, and the understanding is that you will tell stories and then they will tell stories. You go back and forth. And that's, you know, you focus and you're intense about this and you do it for a while. And then, of course, you got to go milk the cows and then you have supper and everything and then it's time to go home again. But it's an important thing and you do it with energy because you know time is short. That's power visiting among the Amish. And I enjoyed it immensely back in the day. So this story fits in New Glarus, and I was in first grade. And I was going to school, it was 2 miles, and sometimes my mom and dad let me ride my bike. I learned how to ride a bike, and it seems terribly imprudent to me now. But I would be weaving, you know, down County Road O and around the corners, and I was very fortunate. Cars always saw me in time to slow down and avoid me, and I'm still here alive today. And I love riding my bicycle now, and I do it across Kansas every year and across Missouri when I can, and just for fun because I like riding bikes. Well, I was riding back and forth, you know, to school most of the time, or I could take the bus, but the bus, I would be the first one on in the morning and the last one off in the evening, so I could get home on my bike way before I would get home on the bus, and that's partly why I did it. I noticed in this field over here, it was kind of a ridge, there was a cornfield, I saw bulldozers over there. And when you're in first grade, bulldozers are the best thing ever. And so I had to stop and watch. And they were pushing the topsoil off and just pushing the corn down. And I was really interested. And that evening, my dad said that he'd seen that too. And he'd stopped to check it out. And what they were doing, they were opening a quarry. And the quarry was to provide gravel. There was a lot of limestone under that cornfield. And they were going to get the gravel out. And they were going to repave and widen Route 69 that went over to Madison. And it was going to take a lot of gravel. And he found out that he was going to get some work there. And he needed a little extra work because, you know, we're trying to pay off the farm and the milk prices were just average. So he started working there, and he was excited to work there partly because it involved dynamite. And he just loved explosions. And I liked explosions too. And so he'd go there, and I'd keep track of what was going on because I was going past with my bike. And after they got that scraped off, they had this machine that drilled holes, and it drilled holes way down in there, and they drilled a whole bunch of holes. And on they worked Saturdays because they were really busy, and my dad asked the foreman, he said, sure, bring Leroy along. And so it was like go to your, you know, dad's children, take your child to work day, except it was every Saturday, and then after school was out, it was pretty much every day. And I liked it because I could help put sticks of dynamite down those long holes. And it was all organized, and they put electric caps in one of the sticks of dynamite, the one at the bottom, and there'd be rows of holes there. And they put, you know, zero delay in this row, and the next row would have 1 millisecond delay, and the next row would have 2 millisecond delay. Tie all those wires together. And then when that was all done, we would pour nitrogen fertilizer down and fill the holes right up. And the fertilizer had been soaked in diesel fuel. We knew all about that stuff back when the Oklahoma bombing went off. We just were quiet about it, but we knew how it worked. And then you got that all ready, and you put little lids on there so that, you know, if it rained that night, nothing would go wrong. And then the next morning, it was time to blow out that whole section of the quarry. And they put a long cord down the little hill, and the foreman would get under a dump truck, and he had this little box with handles that he'd push down. And the rest of us would go out, and we'd stop traffic both directions on Highway O, because sometimes rocks would fly all the way out there. And it was so exciting. I just about couldn't hold still.
And I remember you'd wait and you'd wait, and then all of a sudden, kabaloo! And it was like a huge eruption, this huge fountain of rocks and sort of brownish, yellowish dirt flying up into the air. And the shock wave of that explosion would come, and you'd hear it, and that was fun. But the best part is it kind of compressed my little chest. It just felt like somebody had socked me with a boxing glove. And it was the most delightful experience. I was just like, oh, I was in the middle of this. I was a participant in the explosion. And then we would hurry up to the edge and we'd look down there. And there's this huge, rubbly piles of broken rock and this yellowish cloud of sort of sulfurous smoke down there. And I remember the foreman said, you know, a kid fell down in there once, and that stuff is deadly poison. He was deader than a hammer when we got him out of there. And I was just like, whoo, took a step back there. It was exciting, manly stuff. And so we worked and we worked, and they had machines that crushed the big rocks and made it into fine stuff and trucks to haul it away. And by the end of the summer, that whole highway was all done. And that was the end of the work. And there were still some boxes of dynamite left over. And the foreman didn't want them. And my dad was, hey, choose me. It's like, I could probably. And he said, sure, take them. And so we loaded them in the back of the buggy. And we headed home. And that was more fun than all the money Dad made the whole summer. And we carefully, you know, hid them where nobody would get to them. And then we had to figure out what to do. Because if you have dynamite, you gotta do something with it, right? And Dad was thinking, you know, the bottom 40 down by the creek is always so muddy and gooey and can't get in there. It would be a good idea to put some drainage canals in there. And his plan went like this. We're gonna, you know, like blow a hole and then blow another hole and attach the holes to each other until we had this whole row of holes, and that would be one drainage canal. And if that worked out, we'd do, you know, two more over here. So we went down there with the rack wagon, and by then we had traded out the horses for a 101 Junior Massey Harris tractor, and we drove down there, and we had this auger. And it made a hole about this big, and it had a stem this long and handles on the top. And the first thing we did is we augered a hole as far down as we could, and we put one stick of dynamite in there. And we rigged it all up with an electric cap, and we had just an extension cord. And I got to put the little wires on the battery, on the 6-volt battery there. And I was shaking, you know, but when I hit it, kablammo, and this huge, you know, fountain of dirt came up, and we went over, and we had a hole about this big around and almost 6 feet deep. So we were ready, and we got some sticks of dynamite to put in the bottom, and then we had this huge garbage bag full of soaked nitrogen fertilizer. We'd soaked it with diesel fuel, and we dumped that whole thing in there, and then we pushed dirt over it to sort of help it blow down instead of just up. And we did the same thing, except this time we crouched behind the tires of the little 101 Junior. And it was just like 100 feet of extension cord. So, you know, we went as far as we could, but you have to reach the battery, you know. And this time when we hit the battery, it was amazing. I mean, the whole world shook. And dirt and mud went all over the place. I remember there's a lot of mud on the tractor. And there was some mud on us. And it came down for quite a while after the huge explosion ended. And neighbors talked about how their windows rattled some distance away. And I remember coming to, you know, we came over to see what was going on. And it was a hole. It was probably 14 feet across and deep enough that there was water in the bottom of it. And I remember how the sides were just kind of oozing and drooling down in there. And it was very impressive. And then it was time to go eat lunch. And we were so proud of that huge hole. But we had other stuff to do, and we never got the holes all blown to connect it to the creek. It just ended up being this big pond in the middle of the bottom 40. That's kind of how stuff went. And it wasn't too long after that we moved to Muscadet. We took the dynamite with us, and we buried it in an outbuilding so it would be safe, you know. And one day, my dad decided the house we lived in,
It had just a little tiny cellar under the kitchen. We needed a full basement. That's what he decided. And so he got his little VAC case out, and we had a trip bucket loader and started stabbing into the lawn or the yard until he'd made a trench, kind of just a little ramp going down. And it was deep enough, he took the muffler off so he could just fit under the house, and he just kept stabbing and digging, and we'd put posts up and beams across. And as we went further under into the house, we got into really, really hard dirt. And it was just almost impossible to get that wedge loose. And one day at lunch, he was like, "We've still got some dynamite." And so we got the auger, and we augered. And we'd put a stick or two in, and kaboom, and it would just kind of break stuff loose, and dirt would fly up against the ceiling, floor joists at that time. And it shook the house. And we figured out pretty quickly that you turn the lights off before you do this, because it shook so sharply that it would break the filaments in the incandescent bulbs. And I remember, and it would... We would take turns because it was so much fun to do. We'd do the extension cord, and we have it all hooked up there with the electric cap, and you just plug it into a 110-volt outlet, you know, and boom, it would go like that. The whole house would shake. And mottos would fall, like they'd jump off their hooks and just come down, boom, right down to the floor. And Rose says, she remembers, and we did this like, you know, 10 or 15 times because it was fun. And it also helped break the stuff loose so we could dig it out with the tractor. We didn't want to work hard. We went to great ends not to work hard to do this. She said she'd be like dusting in the living room and boom, you know, go off. Because we didn't tell people. It was more exciting that way. Mottos would fall down. She remembered the Beatitudes just falling down right in front of her. And she just picked it up and put it back up there and kept right on dusting because it had become normal to her. That's the kind of childhood we had, you know. Stuff becomes normal even if it's weird and dangerous, and you'd probably be, they'd call the children's health services now if you did that. Yeah, go figure. I don't know how we survived. We got that all done. And then that was done, but we still had some dynamite left over, and it was there, and another year or two went by, and then the old 101 Junior Massey Harris tractor, it had finally just worn down until it really didn't go very much anymore. The one front wheel bearing had gone out, and so it was a three-legger. And finally, Dad bought an Oliver 88 diesel at a farm sale, and it was huge and powerful, and we just parked the 101 Junior out by some other old cars and things. And one day, Dad said, "You know, the price of cast iron is going up. We could sell the 101 Junior if we had it in pieces. And we could get a little money. It'd be worth our time." So we went out there after lunch, and we looked the thing over, and, you know, it was a lot of cast iron, absolutely. And we were thinking about how we'd take it all apart, and those bolts looked rusty and hard. And then we thought about, well, I always carried a little wrench in my pocket, the one with the 9/16 on one end and the half on the other, because half of all the bolts and nuts on the farm were half or 9/16, and I could take a lot of stuff apart. And so I was looking at that, and we thought of dynamite at the same time. And so I got my wrench out, and in the back was a PTO shaft, and there was a little collar around there with three bolts in it, 9/16 heads. And I got those loose, and you could just pull the whole shaft out, and what was left was a hole that big, right into the center of the tractor. Well, Dad went off to get the last pieces of dynamite, and we didn't have any electric caps anywhere. We just had the caps where you put the fuse in, and then you cut a piece off, and then you stab that into the piece of dynamite, and so he did one, you know, and they were old, and sometimes they lose potency, so we put that all together, put it in there, and we had a piece of fuse, and we lit that with a match, and it fizzled and hissed, and smoke came out, and we moved a safe distance of about 10 feet over here, and we were crouching behind an old rusted-out stock tank, and we were watching that fizzle and hiss, and just our eyeballs peering over the edge there. I remember this. I was right there. You know, it's exciting because you don't know
how long it will take and when it will go. And so you're getting like, is it going to go? And finally it was like, it should have gone already. And you're just kind of like, And finally it kind of, no more smoke. And we're like, maybe the fuse was no good. Is it safe to go over there? And we gave it another couple minutes, and finally Dad was, I don't think it's going to go. And he had two more pieces of dynamite. And so he said, oh, he's going to teach this thing. And he put both of those pieces together and put another cap in and some more fuse, lit that, and we went back to watching, and it hissed and fizzed and fizzled and hissed, and smoke came out. All of a sudden, it was again like a sock in the chest. Just amazing. And I remember looking, and I saw the tractor, and then there was no tractor anymore. It was a miracle. And for a second, it was just confusing. And then all of a sudden, it started raining cast iron. There was this old Cadillac over here, and the windows crashed, boom, banged out of it. There were pieces that hit the stock tank with tremendous force and noise. We weren't even thinking, but we could have died. I mean, all over the place. And I remember I was completely down under here for a second or two, and then things kind of quieted down, and I looked out, and where the tractor had been was the transmission, just the gears and the shafts, and it was 80, 90 oil, really thick oil, and the oil was just kind of oozing out of the gears onto the grass. And way over here were parts of one wheel, and over there were parts of another, and like the front end and a few bits were over there. And all around were chunks of tractor. It was absolutely amazing. We were able to load almost everything up by hand onto the pickup truck. And I think we got like $20 for that tractor. It was back in the 70s, so that was meaningful. But the best part was that it was absolutely amazing. So that's my little, childhood with dynamite kind of thing. And it seemed perfectly normal and perfectly like the thing you'd want to do if you were a little kid back in the time. So it's probably not, you shouldn't try this at home, maybe. That would maybe be the best thing to say to children right now. But you now know a little bit what makes me me. And you know a little bit about our family. And that's what stories are for, is to introduce us to each other. And so I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more about you. I have this wonderful book that you have here, and it's got your pictures and your names in it. So that's part of the fun. I really like that. That's my stories for tonight. We're going to go in a little different direction tomorrow night. But what we can do right now is, if you have some questions, if you have a question, any question about storytelling, about the stories I told, or about my sister Rose when she was little, you're welcome to ask that, and if I can, I'll answer your questions for you. So does anybody have something they want to ask about storytelling? I guess I said it all, huh? Well, here's the deal. If you think of things you want to ask me, you're welcome to. I'm here to encourage you to find your own stories. We'll talk about that a little as we go along. All of us are storytellers because we're human. And I hope, if nothing else, by the end of this little series, that you will learn how to find those wonderful little things in your life that define who you are and sort of make you who you are, and then learn how to tell them in ways that other people will enjoy. So last call. Anybody have something they want to say? All right, well then we can close the meeting. Shall we just stand and then we'll just do a benediction? Let's do that. Thank you so much for your attention.